He nodded. Yes, surprising, isn't it? These towers were immense. The slide read, Babylonian Ziggurat. First step, 300 feet by 300 feet by 110 feet high. Second step, 260 feet by 260 feet by 60 feet high. Third step, 200 feet by 200 feet by 20 feet high. Fourth step, 170 feet by 170 feet by 20 feet high. Fifth step, 140 feet by 140 feet by 20 feet high. Sixth step, 100 feet by 100 feet by 20 feet high. Seventh step, 70 feet by 80 feet by 50 feet high. 300 feet tall, a 30-story building. The next slide will give you some idea of the various gods that the Babylonians worshipped. This slide read, Babylonian gods. Anu, god of the highest heaven. Marduk, national god of the Babylonians. Tiamat, dragon goddess. Kingu, husband of Tiamat. Enlil, god of the weather and storms. Nabu, god of scribal arts. Ishtar, goddess of love. Ea, god of wisdom. Enurta, god of war. Anshar, father of heaven. Gea, mother earth. Shamash, god of the sun and justice. Ashur, national god of the Assyrians. Kishar, father of earth. Throughout human history, men have talked about various gods. Part of the reason for this is the fact that we can look about us and see the grandeur of creation. We ask, where did this all come from? Could it have just happened? Did it just pop up from nothing? There must have been some cause. Something or someone started all of this that we call the universe. This is called the question of first cause. This leads to the second question. With all the intricate design in nature, was there a designer? Whoever the designer was, they must certainly be smarter than me. These two questions lead to the third and fourth questions. Is there a purpose to life, and can I come to know what this purpose is? Murphy paused and glanced at his watch. Well, I think that's enough for today. It will give you something to think about until we meet again. Make sure that you pick up the reading assignment on your way out. Chapter 8.
Dr. Murphy, I appreciate your taking time to meet with me. And thank you for allowing us to videotape your class, Stephanie Kovacs said as she approached.
Murphy was waiting on the patio of the student center. Aren't you going to tape our interview here? Murphy asked, confused. Why is she being so nice and polite? This isn't her usual go-for-the-jugular attack.
No, I asked the cameraman to put everything away. I just wanted to ask you a few questions without having to worry about camera angles.
Okay, shoot.
May I go back a little? A few months ago, you were in the midst of planning an expedition to look for Noah's Ark. Did you, in fact, go to Ararat?
Yes, we did.
The Ark must be a popular subject.
I'm not clear what you mean.
Well, I was looking over the reports from the newswire and ran across a recent one about another team that was looking for the Ark. It was to be funded by a Christian businessman from California. It seems that he had hired Earthlink Limited to take some satellite photos of the Ararat region. The article went on to say that the snow melt on Ararat was the greatest since AD 1500. Evidently, they had discovered something on the mountain that looked like a wooden structure.
We had some photos from the past that we thought indicated the same thing, Murphy agreed.
The businessman put together a team of archaeologists, forensic scientists, geologists, and glaciologists. They were to be led by a guide who had climbed Ararat many times. The guide told the team that there'd been an eyewitness sighting and some photos taken in 1989.
Yes, we too had heard of that sighting.
Everything was set for the trip to get started, and then the Turkish government shut down their expedition. They wouldn't give them permits. They said that it would be too dangerous because of terrorist threats.
Murphy smiled slightly. There may be more to the story, he said quietly.
What do you mean? Kovacs asked quickly.
Her curiosity was a 10 on the reporter's Richter scale.
I think they may have canceled all permits after our expedition.
Your expedition, why?
Because of the murders.
What murders?
For the next hour, Murphy related details of the search for the Ark and the deaths of the climbing party. He carefully omitted information about Talon, the brass plates, and the special crystals found on the Ark. Without evidence, they would only sound like fantasy.
Did you find the Ark? Kovacs broke in excitedly.
Murphy hesitated before sharing the exciting discovery.
Kovacs thought to herself, could there really be an Ark? Murphy doesn't seem to be one of those weirdo right-wing Christian nuts that I've interviewed before. And the murders. Did Shane have anything to do with them?
She shuddered at the thought. Back in the office, the ringing phone broke Sherry's concentration. Bob Wagoner was calling for Murphy.
Hi, Pastor Bob, Sherry said with a grin. How are you?
Very well, Sherry. I saw you sitting at church with Jennifer and Tiffany Baines. How did they seem to you?
I think they're making the tough adjustment to the loss of a husband and father. Since they came to know the Lord, they seem to have a peace in the middle of turmoil.
Yes, we'll all keep praying for them. By the way, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I've been reading the book of Philippians. It's real encouragement, especially chapter 4.
That's great, Sherry. Keep it up. Could I please speak to Michael?
Wagoner was surprised to hear that Murphy was being interviewed by Stephanie Kovacs.
Well, tell him to give me a call when he gets a chance. I've got something I'd like to share with him.
You bet, Pastor Bob. Good to talk with you.
Something in Stephanie Kovacs's tone made Murphy answer her question about the Ark. He couldn't quite put his finger on it. She wasn't being as aggressive as usual. She was asking the right questions for a reporter, but he could sense sadness in her normally fiery blue eyes. She listened intently to everything he was saying.
"Let me ask you a question, Stephanie," Murphy said, turning the tables. "What did you think about today's lecture?"
"It was quite interesting. I didn't have any idea that the city of Babylon was as big as you were describing. It's hard to realize that the Babylonians were as advanced in building as they were. I'd like to hear the rest of your lectures."
"You're certainly invited. What did you think about the last part of the presentation, the part about purpose and meaning to life? Have you found purpose and meaning? Are you happy?"
Immediately, Kovacs looked away. She didn't know how to handle Murphy's question. Murphy had struck a nerve. She was not happy with Barrington. She didn't want to be a mistress. She wanted to be loved for who she was, not what she could do in bed. Murphy knew it would be best not to press the subject. Sometimes it's better to let an important question seep slowly into a seeker's soul.
"Well, Miss Kovacs, I need to get back to my office. My next lecture on Babylon is on Thursday morning. I think you might find it interesting. If you're in town, I encourage you to come."
Murphy was already standing with his hand outstretched. Kovacs wanted to blurt out that he was in danger, but some students were walking toward them. The words just wouldn't come. Silently, she shook his hand, and Murphy walked away. Chapter 9. As Murphy strode toward his office, he could see Paul Wallach leaving the next-door lab. Murphy was about to call to him when Paul turned toward the student parking lot. He seemed to be staring at his feet as he walked.
"He doesn't look very happy."
Sherry was in tears when Murphy entered the lab. At the sound of his voice, she sobbed and reached for a tissue.
"Paul and I had another argument."
"About?"
"The same thing," she said, wiping her nose. "He keeps talking about his plans to join Barrington Communications when he graduates in May. I know it isn't the right thing for him. There is something about Barrington that is evil. I just feel it."
"That sounds just like something Laura would have said. Only she would have added, it's just woman's intuition. Where does that put you guys with each other?"
"I don't know. Paul is so wrapped up in making money, meeting important people, and having power like Barrington. I won't live that way. There's more to life than selling yourself to the highest bidder. Paul's changing, and I don't like what I see.
He used to be more caring to me. Now it's as if he's only interested in making it big. We used to hold hands and walk together and share ideas with each other, and now... Oh, Murphy, I don't know what I should do.
Sherry paused and took a deep breath.
I'm going for a walk. I need some fresh air.
Is there anything I can do? Murphy asked, his concern evident in his voice.
Just pray for me, Sherry said, her voice breaking. By the way, Bob Wagoner called while you were out. He asked you to get in touch with him.
Murphy sat at his desk and reached for the phone. He was worried about Sherry, but he felt sure her strong values would guide her in the right direction. Murphy got straight through to Wagoner, who said,
I have an article you might be interested in. It's about the end of the world.
What are you talking about?
Bob laughed.
Last weekend, Alma and I took a group of high school students from the church down to Orlando to Disney World. While there, I was reading the paper when I noticed an article that caught my attention. It's right up your alley. It is about the end times. I clipped it out and brought it back with me. Let me read it to you. It says, End of the World. Orlando police found an elderly man wandering the streets Tuesday evening. He seemed confused and disoriented. He kept shouting that the end of the world was coming. He claimed that one man would soon rule the world. Police Sergeant Owen East told reporters that this is the third such incident involving this individual. Each time he seemed more and more agitated. Police escorted the elderly gentleman back to a local nursing home. It is believed that he may be suffering from Alzheimer's.
That's a good one, Bob. Send it over. I'll add it to my collection, Murphy said with a smile.
Chapter 10
Did you enjoy your vacation, Talon?
All of his muscles tensed for a brief moment, and anger rushed through his body. Then he relaxed almost as quickly. Years of training to control his emotions took over, and a smile came across his lips.
Vacation?
Yes, it seems like you've taken your time about reporting in. We were wondering if you might have taken a vacation.
Talon was annoyed by John Bartholomew's sarcasm. The man's tone sounded like the British headmaster at the boarding school Talon had attended. He had resented being talked down to even as a child. Breathing deeply, he recalled the pleasure he'd had when he slit the tires of the headmaster's car. It caused him to miss an important lecture in Cape Town. Talon's fingers caressed the gargoyles on the arms of his chair as he drew his attention back to the seven people before him. The blood-red cloth covering the long table they sat behind was very appropriate for them.
I must apologize for my delay,
Talon stated.
It seems I had a swimming engagement in the Black Sea.
There was no point in telling them that he had fallen off the ship and almost been sliced by the propeller blades. They wouldn't care that he had nearly been killed or that he had had to swim 13 miles to shore and spend a week in a hospital due to exposure. All they cared about were results and the fulfillment of their plan to rule the world.
Well, Senor Talon, Mendez said, we understand that you discovered the fabled Noah's Ark.
Even in the dim light, Talon could see Mendez smirking behind his neatly trimmed mustache.
In fact, I did.
Mendez cleared his throat and continued.
Mr. Bartholomew informed us that you made the discovery of some new technology on the Ark that will enable us to control all of the world's energy supplies. He said that it would make oil a thing of the past. Is that true?
Well, I'm not a scientist. As you know, my specialty is the elimination of people. But I think Noah discovered the Philosopher's Stone.
The Philosopher's Stone? The ability to change base metals into precious metals, Mendez exclaimed. Are you sure?
It's only what I heard. I was in the shadows on the Ark, listening to a conversation between Colonel Hodson, the CIA operative, and Professor Wendell Reinhold from MIT. That was just moments before Hodson snapped Reinhold's neck like a toothpick. I then had the pleasure of taking his life.
What about the stone? Bartholomew broke in.
Talon moved slightly. His hands were cold, and he could feel the gargoyles under his fingertips. He knew that the Seven would not be happy with what he was going to say.
"The formula for the Philosopher's Stone is written on 3 bronze metal plates," he explained. "I put them in a backpack along with some curious crystals, a dagger that may have been made of tungsten steel, and other items from the Ark. I had them with me when I boarded the ship sailing from Istanbul to Romania."
"Had them?" Sir William Merton exclaimed. Talon controlled himself and smiled slightly. He could feel perspiration forming on his forehead, and his underarms were damp.
"I had an encounter with Professor Murphy on the ship, and we got into a fight. The backpack slipped off and was lost."
"What?" General Lee slammed his fist onto the table.
"I thought you killed Murphy when you caused the avalanche to bury the Ark under thousands of tons of snow and ice."
"He somehow escaped."
"We don't pay you to make mistakes, Talon,"
said Jakoba Werner, a fleshy German woman with blonde hair.
"We pay you a vast amount of money to destroy our enemies."
John Bartholomew's tone was chilling.
"Maybe we need to find someone else who can do the job."
"I can do it," Talon replied. "I have my own personal scores to settle with Murphy."
"Talk is cheap," Viorica Enesco, an angular woman with a Romanian accent, said.
"It is time for action. Show us what you can do."
Bartholomew again spoke.
"Is there any way you can recover the backpack?"
"I think so, but it will take time to search the area where I went over into the Black Sea."
"We don't want a geography lesson or excuses. We want the plates. But right now, something has come to our attention that needs an immediate response. We have many operatives. One of them monitors all of the newspapers printed by the Barrington Network News. She ran across a small article about an elderly man who talks about the end of the world and a leader who will arise to rule the world. That man must be eliminated."
"What harm can an old man—"
Talon began.
"Enough!" General Lee shouted. "We don't pay you to question. Just do it now. Your very life may depend on it."
Chapter 11 Murphy placed his briefcase on the desk, took out his notes, and surveyed the crowd. His attention was caught by Paul Wallach. He was sitting far back in the lecture hall.
Not in his usual spot. He and Sherry must still be at odds.
Sherry was on the other side of the room, passing out graded book reports. She didn't notice that Paul was watching her. Murphy sighed.
"Good morning, class. Let's get underway. You will recall we were talking about the ancient city of Babylon. The Babylonian Empire was very advanced. The Babylonians excelled in the theoretical mathematics of geometry and algebra. They measured time with water and sun clocks. They also measured degrees of angles precisely. Their numerical system was based on 60. That's why we have 60 minutes in an hour and 360 degrees in a circle. They also utilized a decimal system and knew about square roots and the value of pi. Their calendar was based on lunar cycles with 12 lunar months. Weights and measures were regulated across the empire using metal or stone weights in the shape of ducks."
Don West raised his hand. Murphy could always count on Don to add some unique detail. He was the most well-read student in the class.
"Dr. Murphy," Don said, "I was looking up Babylon on the internet last night. I read that the Babylonians were quite sophisticated in the area of medicine, too. It's believed that they had a superb knowledge of human and animal anatomy and physiology. Also, they understood the circulation of blood and the importance of the pulse. The article indicated they even did delicate operations on the eye."
"That's correct, Don. They were very scientific on one hand and very superstitious on the other. The Babylonians were well steeped in divination and witchcraft. They used magic formulae to attempt to read the future. They used drops of water on oil, noting the direction of the wind and the influence of storms. They also made predictions based on which way smoke blew in the air,
the way a fire burned, and the position of the stars. To the Babylonians, even abnormal births held some significance for the future. Archaeologists have found stones shaped like sheep livers with incantations inscribed on them. The Babylonians specialized in the observation of animal entrails. They believed that the gods communicated through signs, natural phenomena, and worldly events. For example, the sudden appearance of a lion, the eclipse of the moon, or an unusual dream might portend the future. Stephanie Kovacs stepped into the lecture hall through a side door. Curious, Murphy thought. Perhaps she really is interested in ancient Babylon. The Babylonians made systematic recordings of the planets and named most of the signs of the zodiac, Murphy continued. There was a flourishing business of selling charms and amulets to protect people from evil, almost like how we use a rabbit's foot for good luck today. The city of Babylon is very important when it comes to archaeology and Bible prophecy. It is the second most mentioned city in the Bible. The first is Jerusalem, which is referred to 811 times. Babylon is mentioned 286 times. Both of these cities have great historical importance. By now, Kovacs had found a seat in the back and was looking attentively at Murphy. The Book of Daniel and the Book of Revelation both talk a great deal about Babylon. The events of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, Daniel in the lion's den, and the handwriting on the wall at Belshazzar's feast all took place in Babylon. Murphy paused and casually leaned back against the desk. You will recall from previous lectures that the Bible talked about Noah's flood as a judgment against the wickedness. Men could be saved from the judgment of God only by entering the Ark of Safety. Well, the handwriting on the wall at Belshazzar's feast is similar. It was a judgment against King Belshazzar in his wickedness and pride. His kingdom was destroyed, just as the world was destroyed in the flood. The people of Noah's day were given warnings to turn from their evil ways, and they would not listen. Belshazzar didn't heed the warnings of God when his grandfather was punished by going insane. You'll recall that his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar became like a beast and went around on all fours for 7 years. Murphy paused for a moment to let it sink in. Isn't it strange that we do the same thing today? God gives us warnings. He pleads with us and confronts us. You may ask, how does he do this? He does this through the still small voice of our conscience. Our conscience tells us what is right and what is wrong. If we listen to our conscience and do right, happiness follows. However, if we ignore it, we will face destruction and unhappiness like the people of Noah's day or like Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Have you heard the still small voice of your conscience speaking? Have you been obeying it or ignoring it? Murphy stopped talking to let his students reflect. Finally, the silence was broken by the ringing of the bell, which startled everyone. There was not a lot of talking as the students filed out of the lecture hall. Stephanie Kovacs remained in her seat. Chapter 12. Good morning, Stephanie, Murphy called up to her. The two of them were alone in the lecture hall. I didn't see your cameraman.
I didn't think it would be necessary. I was still in town and thought I'd catch your lecture. Do you have time between classes to talk?
Sure, let's go over to the pond by the student center. There are some benches there and we won't be disturbed. There'll be another class in this room in about 15 minutes. It will be anything but quiet.
Kovacs turned to Murphy, her face serious. I need to apologize to you, she said. Her tone lacked its usual cutting edge.
Murphy was caught off guard. For what?
For coming on too strong. As an investigative reporter, I've always approached any story with skepticism. I use my aggression, hoping that it will make the other person nervous and reveal something that would incriminate them. I've tried that with you in the past, and you've always answered truthfully. I've watched you under different stressful situations and have come to realize that you aren't some religious nut.
Murphy laughed. Maybe a little strange, but not crazy. The humor eased the tension a little. Kovacs began to relax and open up.
I've been thinking about what you said in your first lecture. You know, the part about being happy and finding purpose in life. Is it really possible for anyone to be truly happy?
Well, I guess that would depend on what you mean by happiness, Stephanie. If you think happiness means having freedom from any conflict with people, I don't think that will ever happen. We'll always encounter disappointments, hurts, and rubs with our family, friends, and fellow workers. That's part of living. Happiness doesn't mean that we'll never get sick or have any financial concerns. There are many ill people who seem to be cheerful, while a lot of healthy people are pessimistic. The same can be said about rich people and poor people. I know some people who have very little when it comes to earthly goods, and yet they're content. And there are many rich people who are angry and depressed. We've all heard stories of rich people committing suicide.
Kovacs nodded. She couldn't identify with the suicide part, but she did understand those who were angry and dissatisfied. She was living with one such man.
Happiness has more to do with attitude, Murphy told her. Actually, I think happiness is the end result of having a positive attitude toward life, even in the midst of struggles. Someone has said that happiness is like a butterfly. When we chase it, it seems to always elude us. But when we busy ourselves with our responsibilities, the butterfly of happiness lands on our shoulders.
Well, my butterfly must be taking a vacation, Kovacs said with a wry smile. Murphy could tell that there was more behind her quick retort. He knew it would be best to let her talk.
Today, when you mentioned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace and Daniel in the lion's den, it brought back memories. My grandfather used to tell me stories about them. He was a very religious man. He was warm, caring, and funny. I guess as I think about it now, he was probably a happy man.
Did you go to church in your younger years?
Yes, back in Michigan.
Do you still go?
Kovacs paused, then explained,
No, I stopped in junior high school. My father was killed by a drunk driver, and I couldn't understand why a loving God would do such a thing. I guess I got angry with God and stopped going.
That happens to a lot of people.
You mentioned judgment and conscience today. That was really heavy. I haven't thought about God using our conscience.
You sound discouraged.
More like disillusioned. I don't think it's possible to be happy, at least for me.
I think that God may be trying to talk to you.
I'm sorry, Dr. Murphy, but now you are beginning to sound like one of those religious nuts. I don't hear voices. It's always bothered me when people say they hear God talking to them. It sounds like they need to be in an insane asylum somewhere.
Well, let me try to help you understand. Did you ever fly a kite with your father?
Yes, many times.
Do you remember when you would let out the string, how the kite would rise? You could hear the paper rattling in the wind. Sometimes it would rise so high that it almost disappeared out of sight.
I remember that.
When the kite was out of sight, how could you tell that it was still there?
Kovacs looked a little puzzled for a moment. Then she said slowly,
I guess by the pull of the string.
It meant the wind was still blowing the kite.
Right. That's sort of how it is when God speaks to you, Murphy explained with a smile. You can't see him. He is out of sight. And you can't audibly hear his voice because he is too far away. But you can feel his loving tug on the strings of your heart. He does this when you read the Bible. He also does this when you listen to the still small voice of your conscience. That's how God speaks to you.
That's a different concept from hearing voices.
Yes, it is. Let me ask you a question. Do you feel the tug of God on the strings of your heart today?
Stephanie Kovacs's blue eyes began to fill with tears. She turned away from Murphy quickly, but he knew he had given her food for thought.
Chapter 13 Jerusalem, 605 B.C. Blood-curdling cries could be heard everywhere when Nebuchadnezzar's final assault began. With his archers focusing on the soldiers protecting the wall, hundreds of men were dropping in place. He had not been successful in the direct use of siege ladders, catapults, or battering rams. His change of strategy took almost a year to complete. Now a dirt ramp up to the lowest part of the wall surrounding Jerusalem provided the breach that was needed. His well-trained soldiers ran up the ramp, pouring over the wall and into the city. Women and children ran screaming for protection. The army of Jehoiakim fell back as hundreds more were slain. They were no match for the battle-hardened Babylonians. Within a half a day, it was over. The smell of death was everywhere. Soldiers stripped the dead of any valuables and left them lying where they had fallen. The living were herded into the temple courtyard. There, the elderly, handicapped, and wounded were separated from the women, children, and teenagers. The able-bodied men were killed where they stood. Nebuchadnezzar and his soldiers looted the city. He let his men take anything they wanted. He kept only the gold and tapestries from the temple. He would bring these trophies back to the treasure house of his god. Nebuchadnezzar then went to examine the captives. He instructed Ashpenaz, his master of eunuchs, to select young men 14 to 17 years of age to be trained as aides for the king's court.
"I want you to pick out only those who are children of King Jehoiakim or the nobles of the city. They must be healthy and without any blemishes. Make sure that they have wisdom, are quick learners, and are widely read in many fields. They must have poise enough to keep silent and still look good in the palace. The women and children who remain are to become servants for the nobles of the court. Leave the elderly, crippled, and wounded to clean up the city. They pose no threat."
Daniel, along with many other lads, was chained together for the long march back to Babylon. During a water stop at the second oasis, Daniel had opportunity to talk to others shackled near him.
"My name is Daniel," he murmured. "I am the son of Malkiah, the chief judge of the king's court. The barbarians have killed my brother and my parents."
"My name is Hananiah," said the teen standing nearest Daniel. "These are my two brothers, Mishael and Azariah. We are sons of Zephatha. Our father was keeper of the king's treasury. We too have lost our parents. Do you know where they're taking us?"
"I overheard someone say that we were to become slaves in King Nebuchadnezzar's palace."
Mishael nodded toward the man overseeing the slaves.
"Do you know anything about him?"
"The soldiers call him Ashpenaz," Daniel explained. "He is master of the king's eunuchs."
Azariah said fearfully, "Does that mean what I think it means?"
"I am afraid so," said Daniel. "But at least they're not going to kill us."
"But Daniel, don't you want to someday marry and have sons and daughters of your own? How can you stay so calm?"
"Yes, Azariah, I do. But we both know that will never happen now. We must trust ourselves to God. I don't like the idea of becoming a eunuch any more than you do."
Daniel was jolted from his memories when he felt the brushing of soft fur on his face. One of the lions stopped, looked back at him, and sniffed. Daniel froze. He was holding his breath when the lion turned and collapsed right next to him like an overgrown pet. Confused and curious, Daniel slowly reached out his hand and touched the animal's back. It did not move.
"I wonder what would happen if I petted it."
Daniel smiled when the large male seemed to enjoy the caress.
"I must still be dreaming. This cannot be real."
But it was. He could feel the warmth of the cat's body and the rising and lowering of its chest as it breathed. The heat of the cat's body was almost comforting. Slowly, Daniel began to relax. As he started to pray, his memories returned. Hananiah was the first to see it.
"Look!" he exclaimed, nodding toward the north.
The other boys turned to see the majestic city of Babylon in the distance. As they approached, they could see a wide moat circling the city. Merchant boats sailed in the waters that were fed by the great Euphrates River. The wall surrounding Babylon was 300 feet tall and ran for as far as the eye could see.
One of the other captured boys said he heard that the four walls surrounding the city were each 15 miles long. Never before had any of them seen anything like it. The farmers in the fields outside the city walls stopped their work as the prisoners in chains marched slowly by. All types of fruits and crops seemed to be growing. Daniel could see workers dipping water jugs into canals. They stopped and pointed at the prisoners, whispering. Were they slaves too? Daniel wondered. The large bridge crossing the moat was covered with wooden beams. The beams could be removed in case the city came under siege. Anyone attacking the city would have to swim the moat, then climb the huge wall. Babylon was impossible to conquer. The massive gate at the end of the bridge was open. As the prisoners walked forward, Daniel could see that there was an inner wall some distance from the outer wall. The gap between the two huge walls was filled with rubble. No one could cross the gap easily. If invaders somehow scaled the outer wall, they still would have to cross the rubble and scale the inner wall.
Pretty smart, Daniel thought.
After passing through a second large gate, the four boys entered the city and gasped. There were wide streets filled with people and carts and chariots with soldiers. They entered on Eibersabu, the festival street, which ran right next to the Aratu Canal. Buildings on either side of the tree-covered avenues rose to over 150 feet high.
It looks like they touch the sky, said Hananiah. They're enormous.
Soon they passed the small temple of Ninip, which extended over both sides of the canal. Next they beheld Esagila, the magnificently decorated great temple of Belus, dedicated to the god Merodach.
One of the other slaves told me that the temple treasury holds wondrous articles made from gold and silver. Most of them have been captured by Nebuchadnezzar during his many wars, Mishael said.
They strained their necks as they saw the pyramid-like temple rise to over 300 feet.
Can you believe these streets? Daniel asked. They're paved with 3-foot square stone slabs.
It must have taken many slaves to lift them into place.
Azariah pointed.
Look at the beautiful houses and walls made of sun-dried bricks. The mortar looks like black bitumen. And look, all of the bricks have the names and titles of Nebuchadnezzar imprinted on them.
They marched on toward Khazar, a richly decorated building that covered 11 acres. Throughout the city they could see enormous colored reliefs of lions, bulls, dragons, and giant serpents. Huge hunting scenes depicted the chase of the lion and the leopard.
They must have many talented craftsmen, thought Daniel.
Eventually they passed the Ishtar Gate and the enormous middle palace, decorated with cedar and costly woods. The many doors were made of palm, cypress, ebony, and ivory, and framed in silver and gold and plated with copper. The thresholds and hinges were of brass. As the boys passed large statues of Ninus, Semiramis, and Jupiter Belus, Daniel said,
"How sad. The Babylonians worship idols made by human hands and not Jehovah, the true God of heaven and earth."
Hananiah and his brothers were awed by the magnificent hanging gardens. Flowers, vines, and trees covered the rising terraces in a breathtaking display.
"I wish our mother was alive," Hananiah said sadly. "Remember how she could coax life out of the sickliest-looking plant?"
"How did they ever figure out the irrigation system?" Michel asked in wonder. "Those engines that raise the water from the canal to the top of the terraces are unbelievable."
As the days passed, the changes in the boys' lives seemed incredible. Now they were eunuchs. The four boys were grateful, however, that they had had each other to cope with the difficult experience. With the pain behind them, they had to learn how to survive, how to adjust. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah soon began their education in the wisdom of the Chaldeans. The first step took place when Mukhtar, the superintendent in charge of their training, changed their names.
"You will no longer be known by your Hebrew names. You must forget your past. I am going to name you after our Babylonian gods."
"Oh, great," thought Daniel.
"Daniel," You will be called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, I will name you Shadrach. Mishael, you shall be known as Meshach. Azariah, you will be addressed as Abednego. The sooner you realize that you are Babylonians, the happier will be your life. Service in the king's court is better than working in the fields. I too am a slave, you know.
Mukhtar, will you please grant us a request? Daniel asked respectfully.
What do you want?
It is the food from the king's table.
Are you not getting enough?
No, no, that is not it. There is too much to eat. It is not what we are used to. It is too rich for us. Is it possible for us to be fed vegetables and water instead?
What? You will become sickly and weak. If you lose your health, I will lose my head. The king will kill me for neglecting my responsibilities.
Would you consider a test for 10 days?
What kind of test?
Feed us only vegetables and water for 10 days, and then compare us to the other youths eating from the king's rich food. If we look sickly, then we will eat their food also.
One of the lions roared and swatted a female. She cowered as he yawned and strutted around. Daniel could see his sharp white teeth even in the dim light.
"Jehovah, what is happening?" he asked aloud. "Why are you allowing me to live? Is there something you want me to do?"
Daniel's mind began to drift.
"I cannot believe that 3 years have passed," said Mukhtar. "When you first asked me to feed you only vegetables, I thought you were crazy. But you've been healthier than all of the other youths."
"Our God has given us strength," replied Daniel.
"It must be so. He has also given you wisdom. You have mastered our literature and science. You have shown yourselves to have understanding of dreams and visions. This is good, for you will stand before the king this day to be tested. He will ask you many questions to see what you have learned. I know that you will do well, for you are 10 times smarter than the other youths I have trained. I am confident that the king will have you join his staff of skilled magicians and wise astrologers."
"We will serve wherever you place us, Mukhtar," Daniel told him. "But if we have any wisdom at all, it has been given to us by Jehovah."
Chapter 14
"I'm sorry, sir, but you'll have to take off your belt and shoes. We're a little backed up today. The terrorist warning is high."
Murphy bit his lower lip and didn't say anything. It had taken him almost an hour to get through the security check. Oh, boy. Now I get to wait for another hour and 45 minutes before the flight. Patience was not one of his virtues. He didn't like to wait in lines or sit around the airport. It bothered him not to be active, doing something productive. He reached for his cell phone, dialed 411, and asked for the phone number of the Orlando Police Department. As he waited for the automated voice to give him the number, Murphy watched people in the waiting room. He could see a young mother struggling with 2 rowdy little boys. Other people were also frustrated at having to wait. "The events of 9/11 have certainly changed the entire world," he thought grimly. He got the number, then selected the option to be connected automatically. Murphy gave the officer who answered his name and asked to be connected to Sergeant Owen East.
"Are you ready to order, sir?"
"Yes, we are." Murphy smiled at Isis. Her green eyes were sparkling, and her beautiful red hair framed her delicate features. She looked like a supermodel who had just stepped off a fashion runway. Who would have thought that she was an academic? Murphy felt like a schoolboy on his first date. "It's good to see you, Isis," he said in an understatement. "You look great." Her slight smile and her look almost melted him. "Oh, by the way, I've got some great news," Murphy told her. "Vern will be returning to the States next week. The doctors in Turkey say that he's almost fully recovered. I talked to him on the phone from the airport."
"That's wonderful. I hope you don't have any more life-and-death adventures planned. I think Ararat was enough excitement to last for a lifetime," Isis said with a laugh.
Murphy paused.
At his look, she narrowed her eyes.
"Does your hesitation mean what I think it means?"
Murphy looked a little sheepish.
I know, but this is a possible archaeological discovery that would help verify the Bible, like finding the Ark did.
For the rest of the meal, Murphy explained his most recent episode with Methuselah and the contents of the envelope. He concluded,
"We could find Belshazzar's famous handwriting on the wall. I think that Methuselah was telling us it is in Babylon."
"We?"
Murphy smiled.
"Yes, we. I need your help. You have the expertise to determine the validity of the writing."
"You need my expertise."
Isis's normally soft Scottish brogue sounded a little irritated. Murphy realized that he hadn't communicated what he really wanted to say. He leaned forward, stretched out a hand toward her, and said soberly,
"Isis, I want you to go with me.
Even if we don't find anything, I want you by my side." Chapter 15. It was 7 p.m. when Murphy drove his old Dodge into the parking lot of the Quiet River Nursing Home. The gray-haired receptionist greeted him with a smile. He asked for Dr. Harley B. Anderson and was directed to the library, down the hall on the left.
"All nursing homes smell the same," Murphy thought as he strode down the corridor.
There was only one person in the small library when Murphy entered. The elderly man seated at the desk had a full head of bushy white hair. He was neatly dressed in a sport shirt and khaki pants, bifocals perched on the tip of his nose. He was deeply engrossed in a book. He didn't look like someone who was out of his mind and not in touch with reality.
"Excuse me, sir, would you happen to be Dr. Anderson?"
The man lifted his head and paused. Murphy could see Anderson was trying to figure out how a stranger knew his name.
"Yes, I'm Dr. Anderson, young man."
Murphy stuck out his hand. "My name is Dr. Michael Murphy. I'm a professor at Preston University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Do you mind if I join you?"
"Be my guest," the older man answered. "Have we met before? My memory seems to be fading a little."
"No, sir. I became acquainted with you through a newspaper article and a Sergeant East of the Orlando Police Department. The article mentioned something about your concerns over the end of the world."
Anderson sat up quickly. His eyes brightened, and the weariness seemed to erase from his face.
"What did you say you were a professor of?"
"I didn't say, but I'm a professor of biblical archaeology."
"So you know a lot about the Bible?"
"You might say that. I've studied the Bible for many years."
"Good. Then maybe I've finally found someone who will understand. Let me start at the beginning of the story. I am an embryologist. I was one of the early pioneers in the field of artificial insemination and in vitro fertilization. Of course, I've long since retired. Anyway, in 1967, I was working with a gynecologist named Dr. J. M. Talpish on a project in Transylvania, Romania."
As Murphy listened, it didn't take him long to realize that Dr. Anderson was not suffering from Alzheimer's or another brain disorder. The man was as rational as Murphy himself. Dr. Anderson continued,
"We discovered a process to artificially inseminate motile spermatozoa into female eggs outside of the womb. This was done under high-powered microscopes in the laboratory. The fertilized eggs remained in salt solutions in petri dishes until they were implanted into the endometrial lining of the uterus of the birth mother."
"Excuse me, Dr. Anderson, it's my understanding that the first in vitro fertilization and successful birth took place in England in 1978. I believe Drs. Steptoe and Edwards were the first pioneers."
Dr. Anderson frowned.
"They were the ones who got the credit for being first, but Talpish and I were about 12 years ahead of them. We weren't allowed to publish our results or talk to anyone about them."
Murphy was really interested now. Dr. Anderson continued, hardly taking a breath. He had a secret that he wanted to divulge, and Murphy had a listening ear.
"We artificially inseminated a donor egg and implanted it into the uterus of a young gypsy woman, a girl of about 18 years of age. It was a very strange situation. We were hired by a group of people who identified themselves as Friends of the New World Order. They paid us a great deal of money to artificially inseminate the girl."
"When you say strange, what do you mean?"
"Well, this group of people provided the egg and also the semen. Our job was to put them together and implant an egg into the girl. We were sworn to absolute secrecy. We stayed with the project until the birth of the child. It was a boy. Then..."
"Then what?" Murphy was fascinated.
"My associate, Dr. Talpish, was killed in a mysterious automobile accident. I soon realized that it was not an accident. I believe the group of people who hired us had him murdered. To protect myself, I shipped all of my papers and project notes to my daughter in the United States. She placed them into a safe deposit box. I left instructions with her that if I were to die mysteriously, she should mail the notes to the newspapers. It wasn't long after the death of Dr. Talpish that some of the group that had hired us paid me a visit. I had the feeling that they were going to do something to me, so I spoke up before they had a chance. I told them that I had sent my papers to the United States for safekeeping. They were irate, threatened me. They told me that if I ever said anything to anyone, they would kill my wife and my daughter, and they meant it."
"Is your family still alive?"
"No. A couple years later, my wife passed away. It was a natural death. I then went to live with my daughter. She never married. She died of liver disease about a year ago. Then I came to live in this home."
"Have you heard from the group again?" Murphy asked.
"No, they've left me alone. I think they don't want to stir things up."
"So why are you walking the streets telling your story now?"
"I guess I want to clear my conscience," the old man said. "I think we did something terribly bad. I was able to follow up on the boy the gypsy woman bore for about 5 years, and then I lost contact. I think the group moved the woman somewhere, or got rid of her. I'm not sure. Recently, I started doing some reading about prophecy in the Bible. What I read frightened me. It talked about a coming evil person who would rule the world. The more I read, the more I became convinced that Dr. Talpish and I had possibly helped in the birth of that person. It's all in my papers in the safe deposit box."
Murphy was riveted.
"I've been diagnosed with leukemia. The doctors have given me only a few months to live. My wife and daughter are dead, and I will soon be joining them. What possible harm can the group do to me now?"
Dr. Anderson asked with a wry smile.
"I want to try to do something to make up for my past actions. I need to alert people of the danger ahead. I feel so guilty, like Judas in the Bible, the one who betrayed Jesus. How can God ever forgive me?"
A look of frustration and fear came over his face. Murphy could sense the pain that he must have been carrying for years. "God will forgive you," he said emphatically. "He forgives anyone who will come to him, no matter how wicked or selfish they have been."
"I haven't been concerned about God for my 80-plus years. It's too late for me now."
"It's never too late. Do you remember the story of Jesus' death on the cross? Two other men were crucified with him that day. They were both thieves. One of them asked Jesus to save him, just minutes before he was to die. Jesus said, 'This day you will be with me in paradise.' The same could be true for you, Dr. Anderson," Murphy said sincerely.
if you would only invite him into your life.
Excuse me.
The gray-haired receptionist entered the library, smiled at the two men, and said,
I'm sorry, but visiting hours are over. I'm afraid that you'll have to leave now. If you want to continue your conversation with Dr. Anderson, it will have to be tomorrow.
You must come back tomorrow. I have much more to tell you,
Dr. Anderson exclaimed.
Later, back in his motel room, Murphy sat on the bed trying to process his talk with the old doctor.
Could it be true? Could Anderson and his partner have been in on the birth of the Antichrist? That would mean that he is alive today, about 38.
Murphy knew that if he was ever going to get to sleep, he'd have to change what he was thinking about. He turned on the television and began to unpack his suitcase. He had just stepped out of the bathroom when something caught his attention. The announcer said, We have a late-breaking story. A bizarre animal attack took place today when a Sergeant Owen East of the Orlando Police Department was nearly killed by a falcon. Eyewitnesses state that they saw a large bird, which some believe was a falcon, swoop down out of the sky and land on the sergeant. He was leaving work when the incident took place. Another off-duty officer ran to his aid. He was able to beat off the bird with his nightstick. Doctors at Mercy Hospital say that Sergeant East is in critical condition. Dr. Alfred Fordham, the physician in charge, says that the officer's voice box was severely damaged and there was a great deal of blood loss. On another news front,
that has to be Talon's work.
Chapter 16. The black SUV pulled under a willow tree by the curb and stopped. As Talon rolled down the window, classical music could be heard coming from within. He smiled.
Two for one. This will be a good day.
He opened up a book by Edgar Allan Poe and began to read.
Dr. Murphy, I'm so glad to see you,
Dr. Anderson said, smiling broadly.
Would you mind if we went for a walk and talked? This nursing home is quite depressing. It's nice to be with someone young whose mind is still good.
That would be fine. It's a beautiful day. I noticed a small park not far from here. There's a coffee shop next to it. We could get something to drink and maybe even a cinnamon roll.
You've discovered my weakness. I go there often,
Dr. Anderson grinned. Murphy and Dr. Anderson strolled down the path by the park. Magnificent willows shaded the walkway.
Dr. Murphy, before you arrived, I went to the office at Quiet River. The chief operating officer is a notary. I had him witness this letter.
Dr. Anderson handed Murphy a single sheet of paper.
Federated Bank and Trust, New York City, New York. To whom it may concern. The bearer of this letter, Dr. Michael Murphy, has been given permission by me to retrieve items out of my safe deposit box. Because of health conditions, my doctors will not allow me to travel great distances. I therefore have given Dr. Murphy the power of attorney to act on my behalf. Please afford him your kind assistance. Thank you for your help in this matter. Most sincerely yours, Harley B. Anderson, M.D., Quiet River Nursing Home. Witnessed by Lenny H. Harris, Florida Notary, number 12331.
I'm not sure I understand. Murphy looked up at Dr. Anderson, puzzled.
Dr. Murphy, I don't have a great deal of time left. I need to get that information into the hands of someone who can alert the proper people. I think you are that person. I know that we just met yesterday, but there's something about you I trust. Would you please do this for a dying old man?
The plea in Anderson's eyes was hard to resist.
Of course I will, Murphy said. I'd be happy to help you.
Thank you so very much. You don't know what that means to me.
Talon turned down the music, rolled up the window, and started the SUV.
Now it's payback time for my little swim in the Black Sea, Dr. Murphy.
His eyes focused on Murphy and his load of coffee and rolls.
Patience. Just have patience. It's a virtue, you know.
Murphy wasn't aware of the SUV behind him as he came out of the coffee shop. He was looking at Dr. Anderson, who was standing near a park bench,